All right, we're underway here. Hi, come on in. Do you need a notebook?
Sure.
All right, we're underway. We'll be on page 18 of the white outline. All right, page 18 of your exegetical outline notes. And let's do a little bit of a review to get us caught up to where we are in chapter 1. We're in chapter 1, Daniel the prophet. Last week, we took a little look at Babylon, the city that Daniel had been deported to, and we saw that it was a magnificent city. We took a look at the Ishtar Gate, which has been reconstructed. Now, when Daniel got there, the city wasn't as glorious as it is in this drawing, because Nebuchadnezzar would then take this city and he would turn it into the largest city in the known world of the day. He would turn it into one of the wonders of the world. So Daniel saw all that. Daniel was part of all that. He might have overseen some of the projects. He probably saw the construction of the Hanging Gardens and other items that Nebuchadnezzar put together. Now, this is a pretty accurate drawing because we're looking south here. This is the Ishtar Gate. We're looking south. And as we look south, off in the distance, off on the right, you see this ziggurat sticking up. Well, here's a map of the inner city of Babylon. And right here is the Ishtar Gate. Let's see if I can show it for you guys. Right there is the Ishtar Gate. And we're north of that, directly to the north, looking south. And as you look south, there's that ziggurat right there. So that's a nice, interesting, accurate drawing that artist has made. So this is the inner city of Babylon. I have not been able to find any estimates as to the population anywhere. The city was bigger than this. Nebuchadnezzar expanded the city. This is his outer wall here. So here we have the inner city. This is the inner city, this rectangle. And then Nebuchadnezzar's outer wall where he expanded the city over to the along the Euphrates River there. So it grew quite a bit under his reign. So that's the city that Daniel experienced. That was his home for almost all of his life. And then again, here's my impressive picture. Not knowing how accurate that is, but Babylon was an impressive city, and so that's an impressive picture. It was a cosmopolitan center of government, the most dominant empire in the Middle East at that time. We also saw, as we looked at the time frames, that chapter 1 and most of chapter 2 take place during the prophet's present time, chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 38. We also saw that the beginning of the exile was at this time, we could count the beginning of the exile from this time. In Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, in 605 BC, Daniel was exiled along with the rest of the royalty. And we can count the 70 years from 605 to 536 when a small remnant came back and began rebuilding the temple. So that's one way to count the 70 years, captivity to return. The option I prefer is from temple to temple. 586, the temple was destroyed and the times of the Gentiles began. And then in 515, temple construction was completed. And that was a 70-year period as well. So you choose the one you like best. Maybe both of them are valid. But I like to count the exile from 586. One of the reasons for the exile was Jewish idolatry. It had gotten to such a terrible extent that God drew a line in the sand and said enough. And he destroyed Jerusalem and the temple because of that. And idolatry has not been a Jewish problem particularly for many, many years, but I showed you last week that idolatry is back, and here's these ladies up on the Golan dancing before the goddess of Sha'ar HaGolan, thanking this piece of clay here for the forces of life, fertility, and peace, not the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Meditation is now very much mainstream in Israel, Eastern meditation. Kabbalah or Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism is rampant in the ultra-Orthodox community. So is sage worship, worshiping the departed rebbes. So we were exiled from Jerusalem over here to Babylon. And that, of course, is the area of Shinar, Babylonia, or Shinar. That's a synonymous terms for the same area. And, of course, Babylonia is located here in the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley, but the whole entire empire covered this area at its greatest extent. Now, when the articles of the... We learned later that the articles of the temple were taken into the temple of Marduk. And here's a drawing of Marduk. This is Nebuchadnezzar's top god. In his pantheon, he believed this was the top dude. And in his way of thinking, Marduk had defeated Yahweh. Marduk had defeated the God of Israel. And I didn't show you any pictures of Solomon's temple last week, so I thought it'd be nice to do so. Here is a model of Solomon's temple, what some think it looked like. I only have one objection to this particular model, and that's the stairs coming down from the altar. I think those were probably a ramp, not stairway, in conjunction with the book of Exodus, God's command regarding the altar. But the word can be interpreted both ways, so I'm not going to push it. Anyway, that's possibly how Solomon's temple looked. Here is a cutaway of Solomon's temple done by Lean Rittmeyer. He is the premier archaeologist of the day. Who's the guy that draws buildings? Architect. There we go. Say that fast five times. Archaeological architect. I'll get it. He's the premier archaeological architect of the day. So this is his rendering of Solomon's temple. Here's a side view. And the interesting thing about this side view is notice all the walls and coverings of the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place are covered with gold, all overlaid with gold. So I'm sure that tempted Nebuchadnezzar to no end. He did get his hands on it when he destroyed the temple. And inside the temple, not only were the walls covered with gold, but there were many articles of gold, the lampstands, which he took out of the temple to Babylon, the many tables of showbread, the incense altar, and then behind the curtain, the item we talked about, the very controversial Ark of the Covenant, which now apparently rests in 9 different locations. And each person who is committed to a location very vehemently defends his position. It's underneath the House of Parliament in England. It's in Ethiopia. It's underneath the Dome of the Rock, or underneath the Temple Mount. Well, anyway, I think it was probably destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar when he destroyed the temple. He probably stripped the gold off it and melted it down. So I don't think it exists myself. Be nice if it was found. I wouldn't argue about that. But it probably doesn't exist. All righty, that takes us to page 18 of your exegetical notes. And we begin with verse 3 at the top of the page, with the selection of royal children for training. Verse 3. Okay, everybody there? All right, verse 3. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles. So in verse 3, we have the choosing of these people for training. Now the order is given, point A there, to Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs. And true to form, we have another controversy erupt in the third verse. First three verses are filled with all kinds of comments. And the controversy centers around this term eunuch. What does it mean? Saris, that's the Hebrew term there. Now this term sometimes is used to mean a high official, point A2 there, such as in Genesis 37:36. Here is Genesis 37:36. References to Joseph. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph to Egypt, in Egypt, to Potiphar, the officer, the saris of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Now, Potiphar was married, so So it's a quite obvious that obviously that he could be married. And so in this case, the word probably means high official. But that is not the normal meaning of the word. And that's brought out in point three. The normal meaning of the word is a castrated male, a guy who's been mutilated. That's the way the word is used far and above normally. Now why? Why in the world would Nebuchadnezzar do this to somebody? Well, one reason is so their duties could be performed without the interference of marriage. He wanted guys in his government that were there 24/7 at his beck and call. But also, eunuchs were also assigned to supervise the royal harem. And Nebuchadnezzar and men like him didn't want little illegitimate princes running around. All the princes in the harem, he wanted to come from him, not some challenger to the throne. So he wanted castrated males in his harem. Now, that kind of upsets us. We think of Daniel, a godly man like Daniel going through this. But it's quite possible that that's exactly what happened to Daniel and the young men. Let's continue on here. Point B. Who are the young men that are selected by Nebuchadnezzar? He has very strict requirements for the selection. First of all, point B1, the seed royal or the royal family. So these would be members of the house of David. Now, in all probability, Daniel, maybe his three friends, but Daniel at least belonged to this group. He was probably a descendant of King David. David had many wives and many, many children. So he was related to the house of David in some way. Point B, it's very likely that all four were mutilated, were castrated, which is why Ashpenaz is there as the guy in charge of them. And this mutilization of the royal seed is a fulfillment of prophecy, point C. You know, we don't like to think of it, but the possibility is supported by a number of ideas in Scripture. First of all, in 2 Kings 20 and Isaiah 39, God is pronouncing calamity on Hezekiah, on some of Hezekiah's sons. Not all of them, but some of them. Because Hezekiah very arrogantly showed off all his wealth and military strength to representatives from Babylon. Long before Nebuchadnezzar took over. And this is what God says to him because of his carelessness. He says, some of your sons, not all of your sons, who shall issue from you, whom you will beget, will be taken away, and they will become officials, that's the NASB translation, in the palace of the king of Babylon. So those who translated the NASB just couldn't stomach the idea that Daniel might be mutilated. So they chose the term officials. But look how the ESV renders it down below. Some of your own sons who shall be born to you shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Well, if the translation in the NASB is correct, then the judgment and calamity that's coming upon Hezekiah and the house of David is simply deportation. Because to be an official in the palace of the king of Babylon would be to have the good life. But if it includes mutilation, then it is a double calamity. Deportation and mutilation. So I think that fits the context a little bit better, even though we don't like it. Here is Isaiah 37:39-7. Isaiah said the same thing as recorded in 2 Kings. Some of your sons who will issue from you, whom you will begat, will be taken away and they will become officials, NASB, in the palace of the king of Babylon. But again, the ESV chooses the word eunuchs. I think the ESV is probably the more accurate rendering here. So that's some evidence for this position from 2 Kings and Isaiah. There's also evidence from Josephus at the bottom of the page. This is the view that the Jewish historian Josephus took. Here is the quote from Josephus, Antiquities. Josephus says, "But now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, took some of the most noble of the Jews that were children and the kinsmen of Zedekiah their king, such as were remarkable for their beauty and their body, the beauty of their bodies and the comeliness of their countenances, and delivered them into the hands of tutors and to the improvement to be made by them. He also made some of them to be eunuchs." So he feels that's the position of the scripture, the description of the scripture. And he then records that this was the normal course of affairs. This was the normal modus operandi of Nebuchadnezzar, which course he took also with those of other nations whom he had taken in the flower of their age. So Nebuchadnezzar was known for doing this to any of the captured nations, taking their youngest men, their brightest young men, and bringing them into his government in this manner. So while it is a little upsetting, this is probably what Daniel went through. Just because you're godly doesn't mean we are promised freedom from calamities like this. God does not promise us a rose garden. You know, he's not so much interested in what he puts us through as our response to what he puts us through, a response of faith, no matter what it is. Okay? All right, page 19. Page 19. Top of the page, we come to the second class of captives. The first class is the royal family. The second class are the nobles, the nobility. And you'll see in your note there that the three friends of Daniel are often distinguished from Daniel. So they were probably members of the nobility. Daniel from the royal family itself, his friends from the nobles. And then the third class are the young commoners. And they are listed under the term Israel. And you see now that the name is applied to the southern kingdom. Why? Because the northern kingdom doesn't exist anymore. The northern kingdom was destroyed by Assyria in 722. So no distinction exists. Judah is Israel. Judah is the southern kingdom. All right, those are the people he's looking for. Any questions on that? All right, now, what are the qualifications for those he has selected? The qualifications are chapter, verse 4, first part of the verse. Verse 4, first part of the verse. He describes them of use, in whom there was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge. All right, he has some very stringent requirements for these Jewish people, Jewish men he wants to take into captivity. First of all, they had to be young. They had to be between 15 and 20 years of age. We don't know exactly how old Daniel was. We guess he was probably around 15, at most mid-teens. So that's the age requirement. He had physical requirements. They had to be outstanding physically. They had no physical blemishes. They had to be handsome in appearance. So they had to be handsome young teenagers. That's what he wanted. He wanted didn't want anybody in his court that didn't look right on the outside. Okay. Then he also required intellectual qualities or mental qualities. They had to be superior as well. Point C, they had to be, point one, skillful in wisdom. This means they had to be able to learn easily. They had to have a high IQ. I don't know if he gave them an IQ test, but he required that they were sharp. They had good minds, and they could make good decisions. Secondly, he said they had to be endued with knowledge. The NASB translates that phrase understanding. They had to be endued with understanding. And the Hebrew word da'at there deals with individual bits of information. So they had to be able to understand each piece of information as it was taught to them. So they had to have quick minds, and they had to learn easily and quickly. Question. Do I think Nebuchadnezzar was not bright? No, he built an amazing kingdom and city. I think he was probably pretty sharp. But he did surround himself with the very best, yes. I don't think he was a dolt, no. No, I think he was pretty smart. He was smart enough to surround himself with the best, you know. All right, page 20, top of the page. One more requirement in this mental area, this intellectual area. They had to understand science. Now, the NASB translates that phrase discerning knowledge, but the Hebrew word there, mada, refers to a systematic body of knowledge, to a science, like the science of astronomy, the science of mathematics, the science of scripture, that kind of a thing. So I think the Old American Standard is probably the better rendering there. So they had to be able to grasp these little bits of information quickly and then put them in the whole so they could understand the whole picture as well. They had to learn and comprehend all that they were taught. So he has some very high intellectual standards for these young men as well. Now, why in the world would he do this? Well, the last part of verse 4 brings out four reasons why he would want to do this. Last part of verse 4, 4b. And who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. Okay, so purpose number one, point A, middle of the page there, to stand in the king's palace, point one. That means to be given an official position in the government. He's training them for an official position in the government. Now, why in the world would he do that to captives? Point two, I think, answers that. In this case, men would become the liaison between the government and the Jewish community. They would be the administrator of Jewish affairs. Now, when this deportation took place, most of the Jewish community was still in Judah. And so his plans originally were probably to send them back to Judah to manage the affairs. But as the rebellions continued, three of them total, the majority of the Jewish community ended up in Babylon, and only a tiny, tiny minority in Israel. So they would administer the Jewish affairs in the country of Babylonia eventually. And this is very typical of Nebuchadnezzar. Nationals oversaw nationals in his government. All right, so he wanted to find out and create government officials. Secondly, point B, he wanted to teach them the learning of Babylon. He wanted to give them a Babylonian education, probably one of the best in the world in those days. This education would include, point one there, science as we know it, science of different studies. But this would also include areas of the occult, religion, idolatry. That was a major part of Babylonia. Now, don't jump to the conclusion that Daniel and his friends practiced what they learned. You can learn about other religions and not practice them. So Daniel and his three friends were well schooled in the idolatry, but they remained faithful to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Thirdly, he wants to teach them the tongue of the Chaldeans. He wants to teach them the Babylonian language. And the tongue of the Chaldeans, point one there, is Aramaic. Aramaic, similar to Hebrew, but a different language. And this is a subject Daniel did well in because he wrote six chapters of this book in Aramaic. So he was fluent. Now, at the bottom of the page, you see the note on the word Chaldeans. And we note at this point, your outline notes at this point, that the term can be used in two senses in the book of Daniel. How do you know which sense is being used here? Context. I heard somebody say that. Context. Context is king. That'll tell you which sense. Point A, the first sense is a reference to the nationality of the Babylonians, just like people living in the United States are called Americans. So they can be called Chaldeans or Babylonians. But point B, there was a restricted sense in which this word was used. And in the restricted sense, it referred to a class of astrologers, a class of wise men. They were called Chaldeans as well. They were probably the national astrologers, Babylonians who practiced the astrology. And the other groups of wise men apparently included those of different nationalities. So these were probably the leaders of the occult idol worship in Babylon, the Chaldeans, this special class of wise men. All right, so there's three reasons why he's taking them to Babylon. The fourth reason is on page 21, and we learned from secular history a couple of other possibilities. One, maybe both. First of all, he brought them into Babylon possibly to serve as hostages. You see, he left Jewish kings in charge, and there'd be much less chance of a revolt from the Jews if the leaders knew that their sons were in Babylon. You know, you're not going to revolt if your son Daniel is over there where Nebuchadnezzar is. You're afraid he'd get his head cut off. So they were hostages, or he hoped they would serve as hostages. It didn't work. We rebelled against them two more times. So that area didn't work. But secondly, it's possible that he wanted them there to serve as reminders of his conquest and his power, kind of like trophies on the wall, things like that. Okay, so he's chosen young men. We know why he's chosen them. Now their physical oversight is outlined in verse 5. And the details like this are not usually present in the Bible, but this detail is going to create a crisis. And so this detail is important. Their daily rations. Chapter 1, verse 5. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, and at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So we begin with a look at the food, the sustenance these young men were to receive. They were to receive a portion of the king's dainties, Old American Standard Translation, NASB, choice food. So they ate the same as the king ate. They had the same menu. And believe me, he didn't eat garbage, did he? He had the best that his far-flung empire could provide. So they were to eat the best food and the royal wine. Again, the best wine. I don't know if he went all the way to France to get it, but it was at least the best wine in Babylonia and the empire. All right. So the point, the king wanted them kept in the best physical and mental health possible. He wanted them pampered. He wanted them taken care of. He wanted to keep them in the best physical and mental health possible. Now, how long did he plan to do this? The duration, point two, 3 years. That marks the duration of the training. They would be in school for 3 years, pampered students for 3 years. And the goal, point three at the bottom, at the end of the 3 years, they would stand before the king. That would mean that they would be examined, tested by Nebuchadnezzar and his court. If they passed the test, they would be assigned a position in the government. In the government. So in summary, these young men, and we don't know how many there were, they were full-time students on a 100% scholarship to the Royal Academy, Royal Babylonian Academy. And the scholarship consisted of food, shelter, medical care, books, tuition. I don't think they had a laptop, but they had everything else. There was only a small price to pay. Just a tiny little price to pay for all this good life. They had to endure deportation, subjugation, and mutilation. But they were offered the good life. Yes?
I just have an interesting sub-note, I think.
Sure.
In my Bible study, I was assigned a Chaldean Christian as one of my assistants
for
the past 3 years.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to one of Saddam Hussein's generals.
Oh, really?
And
yeah.
His name is Georges Sada, who is a Christian. And I spent some time interviewing him. And it turns out that Saddam Hussein thought he was the new Nebuchadnezzar.
Correct, yes. Really?
General George Asada was head of the Iraqi Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting to hear this summary of what they did for Daniel.
Yeah.
Because I can remember George saying the different things that he was treated, much better than even Saddam's relatives.
Wow. So
Saddam trusted the Christians. Even though they had the Christians taste the food, he didn't feel the Christians
would poison him. Interesting. Wow. And we know Saddam Hussein was not very smart. Maybe you're right, Cynthia. He surrounded himself. Good. Thank you. Thanks for sharing that. That's great. So he was duplicating what Nebuchadnezzar was doing. Wow. All righty. So these three young men, or the ones we're going to look at, the four young men we're going to look at, were facing a demanding, many-faceted, and rigorous curriculum that demanded their full attention for 3 years. All righty. I've got 7:44. Why don't we take our break and pick it up on page 22 with the new names that Nebuchadnezzar gives these young men. So take your break. The nosh is out in the sukkah. Listen for the shofar and then come on back in. We've got a lot of material still to cover. All right, we're underway, and we're picking it up on page 22, new names, top of the page, page 22 point C, top of the page, verse 6. Now, in order to make these young men more Babylonian, Nebuchadnezzar is going to change their names. And changing the names also has another important factor associated with it, and that's the factor that those who were in authority over the position, or over the person, I should say, indicated that authority by naming the person. So Nebuchadnezzar is going to indicate his authority over these young men by giving them new names. So we begin in verse 6 with the Jewish people that have been selected. Now among them, and of course this is all the young men, now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or Azariah, as many people would pronounce it. So Daniel, or Daniel, his name means God is my judge, or God is judge. We talked about that earlier in the introductory material. Now Hananiah, I'm sure many would pronounce it, Hananiah, comes from the Hebrew word Hanan, which means to be gracious or to show favor to. Hanan, to be gracious to. So the name means Yah is gracious. Hanan and Yah. It's a shortened form of Yahweh. Yah. Yah is gracious. Jehovah is gracious. The next name is Mishael. Mishael, literally this means, who is like God? Who is like God is? The idea here is that God is unique. God is unique. So in the Psalms, in a number of places, you read that statement, who is like God? There is none like him. So God is judge, God is gracious, God is unique. And finally, Azariah, or the proper pronunciation, Azariah. Azariah, from the word azar, to help. So Azar plus Yah. Yah helps. Jehovah helps. And here we see that God is our help. Psalm 46:1, God is a very present help in trouble, right? So some observations at the bottom of the page. Two of the names are based on the generic El or Eloah and its plural Elohim. So this is the generic, the word God. That would be our word, our generic word, God. And two names are based on the tetragrammaton, the four letters, Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh, Yahweh, the shortened form of Yahweh, Yah. Now the important point to note, the most important point to note is point three at the bottom of the page. This shows us that these Jewish men, these four, are the products of a godly home. And we see that in the fact that the parents connected the names of their children with the God of the Bible. They didn't connect the name of their children with an idol or with anything else. That's what Nebuchadnezzar said in just a moment. They knew that God is gracious, that God is unique, and that God helped. It was maybe through personal experience. Like Azariah, Jehovah helps, Yah helps. You know, I could imagine that being the child being named because of a difficult birth, right? And it could be gives us. So anyway, the parents of these young men were godly parents, raised them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So page 23. Thank you, Clay. No problem. Page 23, what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He selects different names for these guys. Verse 7. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel, he assigned the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, or Azariah, Abednego. So we begin with Daniel. Daniel was named Belteshazzar. And we're not quite sure what all these names mean, so you'll see various renderings on the outline. Bel was basically a title, meaning master, and it was a reference to Marduk. Remember this guy? He's the master. He's the boss. He's Bel. So it may mean Bel, protect his life, or Bel's prince. We're not sure. Then Whitcomb has another possible rendering that doesn't seem very likely to me. Hananiah, or Hananiah, point B, he received the name Shadrach. Point A, this is a Hebrewized form of the Aramaic Shudur Aku. Now, Aku was a Babylonian god, either the sun god or the moon god. We're not quite sure exactly which god he represented. But this may mean command of Aku or inspired by Aku. But whatever this, whatever Aku was in the Babylonian mind, he was an idol, a god. So you see they're assigning these young men with names associated with idols. Page 24. Top of the page, point C, Mishael. He receives the name Meshach. Basically, it means who or what Aku is. You know, who is Aku or what is Aku? Or possibly, who is comparable to Shaiku? Shaiku is the Babylonian name for Venus. Venus would show up in Greek mythology as the goddess of love, beauty, and fertility. But that's nothing new. The goddess of love, beauty, and fertility has been around a long time, from at least, especially from Nebuchadnezzar's day. And finally, for Azariah, or more properly, Azariah, he received the name Abednego. Ebed meaning servant, Nego, servant of Nebo, or possibly servant of the Shining One, or possibly servant of the shining fire. Now, Nebo, here's an illustration of Nebo. He was the Babylonian god of wisdom and writing. The Babylonian god of wisdom and writing. He was the son of Bel, the son of Marduk, Bel. Nebo, the god of wisdom and writing. Okay?
Are these gods way before
Nebuchadnezzar's time? Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, these did not originate with Nebuchadnezzar. All right, page 25. Again, your outline has some observations regarding names. First of all, the name was given by the prince of eunuchs, Ashpenaz, at point 2, Nebuchadnezzar's command. And remember, the power to name means to exercise authority over. So Ashpenaz was only the underling who delivered the new names to these Jewish boys. We see that in Daniel 5:2 or 5:12, excuse me. Daniel 5:12. Daniel is described here by the queen mother of I think it's the grandson, to the grandson, I believe it is, of Nebuchadnezzar. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king, referring to Nebuchadnezzar, named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation. So we see that Nebuchadnezzar deliberately named these young men to exercise his authority over them. Now, why bother? I mean, he could just add Yahweh to his pantheon of gods and be quite happy. And besides, Yahweh was a conquered god in his view. Why did he bother to do this? Point three, some possibilities. It may be due that the original names were connected with God and brought conviction to Nebuchadnezzar. How did this conviction come? Point four, Nebuchadnezzar did have a knowledge of the true God, for he knew about the predictions of Jeremiah concerning the fall of Jerusalem. We have two cross-references in Jeremiah 39 and Jeremiah 40. Let's take a look at just one of those, Jeremiah 40, verses 1 through 6. What did Nebuchadnezzar know? Jeremiah 40, verse 1. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, captain of the bodyguard, had released him from Ramah, when he had taken him bound in chains among all the exiles of Jerusalem and Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. Now the captain of the bodyguard had taken Jeremiah and said to him, "The Lord your God promised this calamity against this place, and the Lord has brought it on and done just as he promised, because you people sinned against the Lord and did not listen to his voice. Therefore, this thing has happened to you." So the point is, the captain of the bodyguard knows very well that this is the work of Jeremiah's God. Nebuchadnezzar knew that very well as well.
But why would they believe it if they were not?
Why would
they believe that if they were not of that religious predisposition?
Well, they didn't. They didn't believe it in the sense that Jeremiah would believe it.
But they brought it to pass.
Yeah, they brought it to pass. They were the tool. And pointed it to Marduk. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. They didn't fully assimilate what they had learned. Many people read the scriptures and don't get it. You know.
But they do.
Well, they didn't get it fully. Okay.
I'm done.
Let's go on. Any other questions? Okay. So that's one of the possible reasons, that Nebuchadnezzar did have a knowledge of the true God. Point five. Another reason that he might have done this, perhaps to avoid the connection with Jehovah, Nebuchadnezzar gave them names connected with Babylonian gods. So associate them with the conquering gods, not with the defeated God. And we see this was a common practice. Point six, for example, in Ezra 1:8, we read about Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel was his Hebrew name. He was renamed Sheshbazzar. That's a Persian name. So Zerubbabel, the Jew, was renamed. Also, in the book of Esther, we know what Esther's Hebrew name was, Hadassah. Hadassah. She received the Persian name Esther. So this is a very common practice in the ancient Near East. And point seven at the bottom of the page is a little bit of irony. Among Christians today, among the church today, three of these young Jewish men are known better by their pagan Babylonian names than by their Jewish names, which is kind of sad. Now note, changing your name and your environment does not change your character. Nebuchadnezzar took these young men, he dominated them, he took them to Babylonia, he promised them the good life, the best education the world had, he changed their names. But that's all he could do. He couldn't pervert their character. Couldn't pervert their character. And Yeshua says something similar to that. He says, don't fear those who can kill the body. Fear those who can kill the fear him who can kill the soul. So these young men, even though they were externally touched by the best that the world had to offer, still trusted in their God. Their character was untouched. So let's remember that as well. All right, page 26. The detail that we looked at just a few minutes ago regarding their diet now becomes the object of a test for Daniel and his three friends. And we learn in verse 8 that when Daniel learned what his living conditions would be, he made a commitment. And that commitment was not to defile himself. Was untouched. Verse 8. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food and with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now there were two ways that he could defile himself under the Mosaic law. The first dealt with the king's choice food, the king's dainties. First of all, he could be offered meat that was not kosher in accordance with Mosaic law. He could be offered a ham sandwich. That's not kosher, you guys. Pork. He could be offered rabbit. He could be offered a camel burger. Leviticus chapter 11, verses 4 through 7. Leviticus chapter 11, 4 through 7 prohibits these meats from being eaten by Jewish people. Rabbit and camel are included, yeah. I don't know what a camel burger would be like, but I don't particularly want to try one. So I'd get over the hump, yeah. Every time he does one of those, I want you guys to boo. Eventually, he'll stop. All right. All right, so he might have been offered unkosher meat. But another way that he could defile himself is to be offered kosher meat, but kosher meat not prepared in accordance with the Mosaic law. And that would include fat and blood. And Leviticus 17, 13, and 14. Leviticus 17, 13, and 14 prohibits Jewish people from eating meat that includes blood. Here's Leviticus 17, 13, and 14 up on the screen. So when any man from the sons of Israel or from the aliens who sojourn among them in hunting catches a beast or a bird which may be eaten, so it's kosher meat, he shall pour out its blood and cover it with earth. For as for the life of all flesh, its blood is identified with its life. Therefore I said to the sons of Israel, you are not to eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of the flesh is in its blood. Whoever eats it shall be cut off. So he could be offered kosher meat prepared in the wrong way. So those are two ways the meat could defile him. But there's a third way, point C, this meat was often sacrificed to idols. It was part of the pagan worship of Babylonia. And Daniel didn't want to have any part of that. And this is similar to the problem in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 10, 20 and 21. Here's that cross-reference. Here, Paul talks with the Corinthians. They're having the same problem. He says, I say that the things which the Gentiles sacrifice, they sacrifice to demons and not to God. And I do not want you to become sharers in demons. You cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons. You cannot partake of the table of the Lord and the table of demons. So the Corinthians had problems with meat offered to idols as well. So Paul didn't want them to be associated with anything like that. So Daniel took the same attitude. So the king's choice food could have defiled him, but also the king's wine, point two. Second way he could defile himself. Now, wine in itself is not forbidden in the Mosaic Law. But wine was also used in the sacrifice to idols in Babylon as well. Point C, it was used in the worship of the Babylonian gods. And we get a glimpse of this in Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Add one verse to that cross-reference there. Make it verse 4. All right, here's Daniel chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Belshazzar, he's the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and the silver vessels, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. So he issues a very specific order about some very specific gold and silver items. And they obey. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. And they drank the wine and what? They praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze and iron and wood and stone. So they took these items used for the worship of the Lord, made out of gold and silver and etc., and filled them with wine, and they praised idols made of gold and silver and drank the wine. So they associated those items with idol worship. And the wine was associated with idol worship. Daniel didn't want any part of that. So point three, toward the bottom of the page, what did he do? He requested to Ashpenaz, the prince of the eunuchs, to be allowed not to defile himself. And he did this because he was internally convinced that this was the correct course of action. Totally convinced that this is correct. And we'll see that he took a huge risk when he did this. Well, how does Ashpenaz respond? Verse 9. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. So we begin with Daniel standing before Ashpenaz. Ashpenaz had a very kind attitude toward him and a compassionate attitude toward him. So he had a very positive relationship with Ashpenaz. Now, what was the risk that Daniel was undertaking when he went to this Babylonian official? He had at least four things were risked. First of all, he risked expulsion from the Royal Academy because he wouldn't stay in the best of condition. He was defying the order of things here. So he could have been expelled from the Royal Academy. Expelled from the good life. Secondly, if he was expelled, he would be in disgrace. So instead of honor, he would experience disgrace. Instead of the good life, expulsion. Thirdly, this could very well be taken as a direct insult to the king. After all, he had chosen him, he had named him, he had given him the best And now this Jewish kid is an ingrate. He doesn't want it. So Nebuchadnezzar could have been insulted, and four, he could have very well been killed, executed for his insult to Nebuchadnezzar. So Daniel was risking it all, his life and his lifestyle, when he went to Ashpenaz. But Ashpenaz had a positive view of Daniel. Page 27. Ashpenaz's refusal in verse 10. Here's how he responds. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king." So we see here Daniel had reason to fear, didn't he? Daniel was risking everything, and Ashpenaz wasn't willing to step out on a limb, to stick his neck out literally for him. Ashpenaz could be executed for disobedience, for dereliction of duty. He didn't want to lose the good life or his head. So does Daniel give up? Oh, I guess what God wants me to eat the food with the blood in it. But I guess it's God's will. No, Daniel perseveres. Daniel perseveres, and he makes a request of the steward in verse 11. But Daniel said to the overseer, whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Notice point 1a. The steward is appointed to work under Ashpenaz. And he's the underling directly responsible for waiting on Daniel and his friends, giving them the food. Now, point C is important. This man does not answer directly to Nebuchadnezzar, so he has some wiggle room here. He can experiment. He can push the envelope a little bit. So now Daniel makes the request in verses 12 and 13. "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food, and deal with your servants according to what you see." Well, Daniel designs a creative alternative. And he makes a very respectful appeal. He gives the appeal a measurable length of time, 10 days, reasonable. "Give us only pulse to eat," Old American Standard Translation. Pulse was food that grows out of the ground, point two, vegetables and grain. Now under the Mosaic Law, point three, there are no unclean vegetables. All vegetables and grains are clean, except Brussels sprouts.
I'm with you on that.
You're with me on that one. Yeah. Hey, I got a couple of people here that agree with me. It's in there. Check out your study your word diligently. You'll see that Brussels sprouts is forbidden. All right.
You're just trying to get us to take
So, give us vegetables and C, give us water to drink instead of the wine. Then compare us, and the decision is yours. Do with us as you see fit. Now, what does the steward do in verse 14? The steward. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. So the steward agrees to go through with this. And right here we have a great application that we all need to think about. Because, and I'm going to hand out these next two slides to you. So you want to break your fingers writing it all down. Now, the reason I want to harp on this application is because we are all going to be faced with choices like this sometime in our walk with the Lord. Sometime. Whoops. Oh, I didn't grab them all. Sorry, Southern Kingdom. I'll get the... Buck up, Stevie. I'll get you some. I'm sorry. Sometime in our life, in our walk with the Lord, we are going to be faced with issues like this. So we need to be prepared for it now before it happens. It can happen at work. It can happen in your family. It can happen at school. It can happen in your neighborhood. For example, for myself, I was in commercial photography for many years and in commercial printing. Stevie, here's some more. Thank you. I was in commercial photography and commercial printing. So whenever I applied for a job, I had to tell the people I interviewed with, any extras?
Oh, yeah.
I had to tell them, what are your clients? Do you shoot pornography or do you print pornography? If you do, don't bother to offer me this job. And, you know, I didn't run into a lot of problems with that. But I remember once in the photo studio I worked in, the boss shot some questionable pictures on the weekend and wanted me to process them. I said, sorry, I can't do that. He got mad at me, but he didn't fire me. And I remember in one of the print shops I worked in, thank you, Steve, one of the salesmen brought in an advertisement for a limousine service, and it was nothing but a front for prostitution. So I said, don't give me that job. I'm not going to work on it. And my, right up over here, Steve, thank you. And my supervisor was a Christian. When he discovered what that job was, he said, who brought this into the shop? And he went to that salesman and said, don't you ever bring in stuff like this to the shop, okay? So we're going to be faced with those issues. So we need to prepare ourselves now on how to deal with them. So the question we have to ask is, what do you do when you're asked or ordered to do something you feel is wrong by your authority? Okay? Well, get ready before the crisis, okay? You're probably going to flunk the test if you're not prepared for it, just like any final test. If you're not prepared, you're going to flunk it. So get ready before the crisis. Be prepared. Be a good Boy Scout. Number one, always exhibit an attitude of sincere goodwill and faithfulness toward those in authority over you. Have a good attitude toward your authority at work or wherever it happens to be in the government. You know, all governments are set up by God. We have to acknowledge that. Secondly, continue to cultivate a friendly, gracious, kind relationship with your authority. That's what Daniel did. And Ashpenaz and the steward looked upon Daniel with kindness and graciousness. Thirdly, and this is most important, study your Bible diligently so you know and are convinced internally regarding what God considers right and wrong. Okay, that's what Daniel did. He knew his Mosaic law. He knew what he was supposed to do. We have to do the same thing. We have to be diligent students of the Word so we know what is right and wrong. Okay? That's a big job. All right. This is your preparation. Now the crisis comes. How are you going to handle it? One, choose your battle carefully. Do not object unnecessarily. If you're whining and complaining about every little thing, your authority is going to be going to consider you a pain in the neck. He's not going to have a gracious, kind attitude toward you. So don't be a whiner and a complainer. Okay? Choose your battle carefully. Secondly, choose a clear-cut issue of biblical obedience and faith. And you've learned what that is because you've been diligently studying the Word, right? So choose an issue that you're willing to go to the wall for, not just any old issue, not a gray area. Clear-cut issue of obedience and faith. Thirdly, design a creative alternative. How can I satisfy my authority and my conscience and the Lord? Creative alternative. That's what Daniel did. Fourthly, choose the best authority to ask. Use seichel, use common sense. Daniel didn't ask the best authority the first time. Ashpenaz was not the best authority to ask. The steward was. But he persevered and he found the best authority, okay? He found that steward. Fourthly, make a respectful appeal to the authority. Don't go up to him and tell him, you dirty pagan, you're going to go to hell. Now, don't let me defile myself. Okay? Hey, there are Christians that say things like that. Okay, make a respectful appeal to your authority. He is your authority. She is your authority. Okay? Allow God to act. That's what Daniel did. Put us through this 10-day test. The decision is up to you. He's allowing God to act in the life of the steward and in his life. Sixthly, if the answer turns out to be no to your creative alternative, graciously refuse to do wrong. Just stand there and say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I can't do that. And that means, point eight, you may have to suffer the consequences of obeying God rather than man. See, the authorities God puts over us are not unqualified authorities. They are all put over us by God. They have to answer to God. So do we. So we need to be ready to suffer the consequences of obedience to God rather than man. We see this throughout Scripture. That's what Daniel did, okay? So dare to be a Daniel. Question.
In daring to be a Daniel, he also prayed. Could we plug in somewhere, pray?
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Oh. Okay.
We haven't quite gotten to that verse. So yes, you're right. We will see that Daniel will pray. So if you want to write that in, that's fine. That's fine. We'll get to that. Thank you. All righty. I've kept you 5 minutes over, so let me go ahead and pray. And speaking of prayer, and then I'll turn you guys loose. All right. Father, again, we want to thank you for your word. We want to thank you for Daniel and his courage, his commitment to you, and his faith. And so, Lord, we lift ourselves up before you, and we ask that you would help us dare to be a Daniel as well. When we come across a crisis in our life, Lord, help us to be ready, to be prepared, because we know your word. We've hidden it in our hearts so we won't sin against you. And then help us to follow the example of Daniel as we work with our authority. But, Lord, if the answer is no, and if our authority is unwilling to acknowledge our personal convictions, then help us to be ready to bear the consequences, because we know that you will honor those who honor you. And we thank you in Yeshua's name. Before we go, that's one thing I forgot to do. Daniel is a perfect example of 1 Samuel 2:30. 1 Samuel 2:30, God is chewing out the house of Eli, and he says, therefore the Lord your God of Israel declares, I did indeed say to your house, and this is the house of Eli, and the house of your fathers, and the house of your fathers should walk before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me I will honor, and those who despise me will be lightly esteemed. What did Daniel do? Daniel honored God. God honored Daniel. Now, that's not a guarantee that God's going to get you off the hook every time, but at least the Lord will be very positive toward you if you're honoring him, okay? All righty. Thanks, you guys. We'll see you next week.